Hello, if you're a book reader, and even if you're not, I'd like to invite you to join me, Aaron Hicklin, every Sunday at noon for Shelf Life on WJFF Radio Catskill, a show about books and the people who love them. Each episode, my guest picks two of their favorite books. I read them, and then we get together to talk about them. That's Shelf Life on Sundays at noon on WJFF Radio Catskill.
WJFF, Jeffersonville, W233AH, Monticello.
Good morning. Welcome to Catskill Character. I'm your host, Donna Fellenberg, and with me today is T. Martin Higgins, who with his husband, Charles Wilkin, is co-owner of Two Queens Coffee in Narrowsburg, New York. Charles is an artist and beekeeper, and Martin is the coffee roaster. He has a real passion for it, but he wasn't always so purposeful. He kicked around for a while and finally graduated from college when he was 29. What was his journey from Columbus, Ohio to Narrowsburg, New York? Let's find out. Here we go.
Thanks so much, Donna. I'm honored to be here.
You know, you have a very interesting adoption story that we're not making the focus of the show today, but it's something that I'm always interested in because my son is adopted. If I ever get an opportunity, I encourage people to consider adoption. Because there are so many kids out there who need good homes,
yep.
and they need you. So I'm just putting that little plug in.
I absolutely do. I agree.
You were able to track down your birth mother, and I know you wanted to get medical history. Were you able to get what you wanted?
Yeah. The backstory there is my mother had Parkinson's, and as it, you know, continues to get worse. Parkinson's is one of those terrible diseases that only progresses and gets worse. And then it made me realize, because my sister, who is not adopted, was really staring down all the medical things because my father died rather young of cancer. So, you know, the medical history in the family is not super awesome. So she was very concerned and thinking about those things. And it made me realize that I knew nothing about my personal medical history whatsoever. And it did sort of spur a long, idling curiosity to track down my birth mother. So happened that Ohio, where I'm from, changed its sealed adoption law. And I was able to get my original birth certificate from the health department. So once I had that, then I had her name. And it turns out she grew up just, I don't know, a mile and a half, 2 miles from where I grew up. And as I was searching, because she was 17 when I was born, so she's not so old yet. I wasn't finding a lot looking through public records and things like that. And I was talking about it to a friend who said, well, did you try on Facebook? And I thought that was the most ridiculous thing, but it took me like 5 minutes and there she is. She's not on Facebook, but she was in a family photo from a big reunion. And then in sharing that, I clicked around in the photos, the one main photo with everybody in it. And I realized that I had a mutual friend with one of the people in the photo. I mentioned it to her and she said, stop, this is hilarious. I know the whole story because my mom and her and your grandmother were best friends. So I was able to then, you know, get her current address and send her a letter. And we've had a letter writing correspondence that's been super interesting and, you know, things I never thought I would know. So
yeah,
that's been pretty cool.
When we were talking about this earlier, you mentioned that boys seek out their birth mothers less than girls. What's the going theory on that? Do you know?
My longtime friend, Don Friedman, who is a family counselor, who has a child, she was an open adoption. So she's very, I don't know, in the know about all things related to adoption. And she's someone that, you know, even through our teenagers had always encouraged me to join, you know, different groups. There was a group that was sort of a rebel rousing group to get the adoption laws changed because the records were sealed. And unless you had a medical condition that required like, you know, transplant or something from a blood relative, they would not unseal them for any reason. So that was finally changed, but there was some group called Bastard Nation that was trying to get these laws changed. And she was always so curious about it. And I wasn't really that curious about it. I was perfectly happy with the family that I grew up with. And I didn't see any reason to look for a new family. But she told me that that is a little factoid that seems to ring true. largely the theory there seems to be that when women reach childbearing age and have a child of their own, then they are that much more curious about their own birth mother, because going through that childbirth experience and then, you know, the bonding that happens along with that makes them realize their mother probably, you know, had a lot of sleepless nights over that before, after, and maybe always since. You never really know. So because I was born in 1971, before Roe v. Wade, there were definitely more adopted kids that were my age that I grew up with. And some people are very interested in it and some are not. And I've known a lot of folks that have had very happy reunion stories and some that didn't go well at all. So, you know, there's always the risk that it might not be what you hope.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a risk in everything. So your parents adopted you and then unfortunately they broke up when you were about 16 years old and your father left for the Caribbean. And I was wondering, looking back on that, what kind of an impact did that have on you?
Yeah, my parents were really cool, interesting people, I have to say. And they were very social. They were in all the clubs, all different like social clubs and arts and music. And they, you know, were very involved in things and volunteering and active in their church, very Catholic. My mom was a Catholic school teacher. She taught art at the school that I went to. I had my mom for a teacher for 4 years and was not allowed to call her mom or get an A in her class. and my dad was from Nebraska and moved to Ohio in the early 60s. He worked for Weyerhaeuser Lumber. And he and my mom met on like a blind date and they hit it off. So, but then my dad started a number of businesses and he was really good at ideas, but not really good at running businesses. So none of them did particularly well. And things just got a little bit more tenuous. And then the house of cards sort of crashed. It had put their marriage under a lot of stress. And my mom said, if we lose the house, we're done. And he had put too many mortgages on it and something fell apart. And he knew that we were going to lose the house. So he ducked out and took the boat that he'd refurbished with a friend and disappeared to the Caribbean somewhere. And we didn't see him for a number of months. And the house got foreclosed on and the cards got repossessed. And my mom had to rebuild everything from scratch. And she was pretty blindsided by it because he didn't tell her everything because he knew it would upset her. And I think he also knew it meant his marriage was going to end and life as he knew it was going to change very dramatically. So,
and life as you knew it was going to change very dramatically.
Yeah. And I was a very angsty, angry teenager. And so being in suburban Columbus, Ohio in the late 80s, knowing that I was gay, absolutely not excited to tell anyone about that because that seemed like the worst thing possible to me at that place in my life. I just was mad at everything all the time. So my parents getting a divorce and everything changing that way only kind of added to my gothy, you know, all dressed in black, angry teen ways. And my mom was wonderful and she figured out, you know, how to keep us in the same school system. And we just moved to the other part of town and she got a townhouse where she then lived for another 26 years. As soon as high school was over, and I graduated when I was 17, so I had to wait until September after I graduated in May.
I don't want to jump ahead too much because there's a very funny story about you when you were still in an all-boys Catholic school and you just were having none of it and you managed to get yourself thrown out, but you did it in such an ingenious way. I really want you to tell the listener about that.
Sure, that was sort of a funny story. So I went to Catholic school, as I mentioned, first through eighth grade at a school that my mother taught at. My mother's mother was the second grade teacher at the other Catholic school in our town. And my uncle was the, still is the director of Catholic Social Services in the Diocese of Columbus. So they were all very involved in the church. So I had finished middle school, and then it was assumed that I would go to the co-ed Catholic school that everybody else was going to. But my dad really wanted me to go to St. Charles, which was an all-boys Catholic school way on the other side of the city. No buses to get there. It was a whole situation with travel and carpools and all that goes with that. And I thought, okay, if this will make my dad happy, if he'll be, you know, proud of me to go there, then I'll give it a try. It was a terrible mistake. From the first day, it was awful. They wouldn't call me. Martin is my middle name. My first name is Thomas. I'm named after my father. I'm a junior, but my mom only agreed to that setup if they could agree that I would just go by my middle name, because she didn't want the whole junior senior thing. She thought that was going to be annoying. So somehow my middle names weren't on the roster at the new school. So first day, freshman year, a couple kids that I rode to school with that were upperclassmen were like, we're going to beat you up if one more kid calls you Tom, because your name isn't Tom. But it took me a while to sort that out. Anyway, it went on like that for the whole first semester, and it just got worse and worse, and I hated it there. It was terrible. So I decided that I wanted to transfer to the public high school, which was a very good public high school in the suburb that we lived in, would make everybody's life much easier. So I went through the student handbook, and I found some loopholes. So it did say we had a dress code, not a uniform. So it said that you had to wear a button-down shirt and that you had to have your top button buttoned and you had to wear a tie, but it did not explicitly state that you had to wear the tie around your neck. So I said, aha, this is going to be my thing. So I wear my tie like around my arm or tied around my thigh or run it through my belt loops or something like that. And, really got the ire of the teaching staff up. So I got called down to principal's office, Father Bennett, who was a very intimidating old priest. And I just very calmly, you know, got out the handbook and I had highlighted the section that was problematic. And I said, look, if you want to correct this and reprint this and redistribute it to the entire student body, I will comply. But until then, it doesn't say that. And that's not what I'm going to do. So he kind of bounced me over to the guidance counselor, who then called my parents and said, you know, we just don't think this is working out. If you could come and get him, we will even refund you your second semester tuition, which apparently was a thing they did not often do. My parents were definitely caught off guard by this, but we went in, had a meeting, and we went straight over to the public school because I had the day before already set up a meeting to enroll me, pretending that I was my mother on the phone. So that worked out well. My parents didn't even know what hit them. And all of a sudden I had, you know, the new freedom of going from a school of 400 to a school of 2400 without a dress code and all the things that I was accustomed to in Catholic school. It was like,
yeah,
I was finally free.
Bravo. And you, for a Catholic boy, you know, you had a lot of chutzpah. I have to say. You know, it's really interesting that your father was in the lumber business and you ended up living in the Catskills. You had many, many different jobs, including working for Victoria's Secret. You had a circuitous route to your career as a coffee entrepreneur. But the thing that really stands out for me, Martin, is you're such a good example of never giving up and keep going till you find your purpose. And even though you started working in the coffee biz when you were very young, you went through all these other jobs we don't have the time to list. But my hat's off to you, because here you are in Narrowsburg, you're the king of coffee, and we're all the beneficiaries of that. So thank you for that. I think we're going to take a quick break here and we'll come right back.
Absolutely. Okay? Thank you for saying that.
You've been listening to Catskill Character on Radio Catskill. I'm Donna Fellenberg, and my guest today is T. Martin Higgins. Not Thomas, Martin Higgins. We'll be right back after these messages.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Community Foundation of Orange and Sullivan, working with charitable people, businesses, and organizations to support worthy causes through more than 360 charitable funds. CFOSNY.org. Ba and Me, classic Vietnamese food made to order from fresh ingredients, with locations in Honesdale and Livingston Manor. Menu and hours online at baandme.com and on Instagram and Facebook. And from listeners like you.
We've known about long COVID since the early months of the pandemic, but still,
there's absolutely nothing anywhere that's clear about long COVID. We have a guess at how frequently it happens, but right now, we're really, everyone's in a data-free zone.
For now, getting better involves trial and error and a lot of patience. That story Monday afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
On this week's On the Media, libraries, what they're after, and who's after them.
It's not about the book. It is about wanting the library itself to disappear.
The dream of accessing the knowledge of the whole world and the risk of losing it all. On the next On the Media from WNYC.
Saturday afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
Welcome back to Catskill Character. If you've just joined us, my guest today is T. Martin Higgins. Martin and his husband, Charles Wilkin, own Two Queens Coffee in Narrowsburg, New York. Let's find out more about the coffee business right now. Martin, you were working, as I mentioned in the first half of the show, in the coffee business very early on. Would you give the listener a quick tutorial about coffee roasting?
Sure, absolutely. I got really interested in coffee actually when I was in high school. My parents made terrible percolator coffee, as so many people did back then, even though it's hip again, but I'm sure it's better now. And I thought coffee was terrible. Smelled great, but was terrible. And then I went to a real coffee house on the Ohio State University campus, which was near where I grew up, and had real coffee, some Sumatra dark roast. It's still one of my favorites. And then I got really into it and got my first job at a legit coffee place when I was about 20. But for the tutorial about roasting coffee, there is a lot that goes into it. And I think that's part of why I like it so much, is because it's pretty complicated. The coffee grows mainly in Asia, in Indonesia, Eastern Africa, Central and South America, a little bit in the Caribbean. No coffee in North America or Europe. The climate just isn't suitable for it. So there are a number of different varieties of coffee plants, the two main varieties being Robusta and Arabica. And Arabica is the specialty coffee. Robusta is the stuff that has more caffeine, but is more bitter. And that's kind of more what people are familiar with in like the grocery store aisles, the 8 o'clock coffee, the canned stuff. The better stuff is more finicky and needs different growing conditions, often grows at higher altitudes, and then is processed in a way that's continuing to evolve even to this day. People that are into coffee may know of the term like third wave, which is what we're considered to be in right now. I kind of came into coffee in the second wave in the early 90s, but now everything is about measurement and anaerobic treatments to the green coffee before it is packed and shipped out to, you know, places like the United States, where we then do our magic on the roasting end. But we have to source all of our green coffee. So we work with a number of different importers, get samples, roast the samples, cup the samples. During the pandemic, when things were a little less busy, I took the opportunity to go get certified as a Arabica Q grader, which is similar to being a sommelier for wine, but for coffee. So that is a process where you have, you know, there's like 27 different tests that you have to pass that are all about the finite minutia of tasting when something is a little bit off, or there's something wrong, there's a flaw in the coffee in some way, which is fun and challenging. But it also makes you a better taster. It makes you understand, you know, this is going to balance that coffee for a blend that everyone will love. So that's what I really enjoy about it, is the creating something that not only I will enjoy, but other people will enjoy as well.
I just want to ask you one quick question right here. Have you ever gone to any of the countries where the coffee is growing to actually see the coffee in the ground, as it were?
Yeah, we've been to Costa Rica, but we didn't do specifically like an origin trip, is sort of how they talk about it in the biz. But that is, it's funny that you bring that up, because it's something that I'm working on a couple of itineraries for that for the coming year. So that's something that we're definitely going to do more, because there is this movement now of trying to connect the whole value chain in coffee, so that the roaster and the barista, the people that are, you know, selling the coffee and the final product in the cup, have some understanding, the through line of where everything comes from and how much effort it takes to get that coffee to you in the first place. It's quite an ordeal to get coffee. And for the business to be as big as it is, it just continues to grow and grow.
It's amazing, isn't it? Because we're really big here, and I guess everywhere at this point, on farm to table, restaurants, right? Because people want to know where their food is coming from. But when you go into a shop to get coffee, you have no idea about all this.
Yeah, and that's starting to change because there are ways to do that now better. So used to be what would happen is all the growers, which typically are, especially for specialty coffee, tend to be smaller farms. So those small farmers don't own the processing plants where the coffee is washed and sorted and processed. So they just bring the beans, they're weighed, they evaluate it, they give them a price, and then that washing station, you know, takes all the things in and would mix them together, blend everything together, and then it would be hard to say which farm something came from. It just came from a region. So now they're much more focused on keeping those small lots as small lots all the way through the process. So that way we have traceability and we can say this coffee came from this farmer on this farm in this region of the farm at this time, and everything is kept separate. Of course, that is more work to do in a way because it's harder to keep everything together than to just mix it all in. So it increases the cost through that value chain. But there's also a push to get the growers more of the price of the coffee. You know, a lot of the importers that we work with are trying to pay the growers more money, which seems like a funny thing. It seems like the opposite of capitalism, but when the people that are actually producing the product are not making a livable wage, something is out of whack.
Absolutely. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Makes you proud to be a coffee roaster, doesn't it?
It is. It's a fun thing. And it's something that, you know, for a long time, I never thought I could make a career of that. There were small paths through, but I left coffee and went into public relations for a number of years and then came back to it because, as you mentioned earlier, my father was in the forestry lumber biz and my parents owned a Christmas tree farm when I was growing up. So that was a large part of my growing up life. Even though we lived in the suburbs, our farm was about an hour into the country in southeastern Ohio in the Hocking Hills, which the Hocking Hills is very similar topographically and in its sort of rural nature to this part of the Catskills where we are. Yeah. So when we first came up here, I instantly felt a connectedness. It's like, this is very familiar to me. And it's very close to New York City. So, you know, we came up first as weekenders, but in pretty short order, I really felt like I wanted to be here and not in the city anymore. And it took a little while until we were able to figure out how to make that happen. But the magic was transitioning out of our PR, for me anyway, transitioning out of my PR career and back into coffee, because Charles and I had started Two Queens as a little hobby project. It first started with him becoming a beekeeper. And then as a graphic designer, he couldn't help himself from making some awesome packaging for the honey that he was just giving to friends and family as gifts around the holidays and things. And everybody responded with like, wow, this is great. You should sell this. So we just did that at farmers markets. And then we, you know, honey's hard to scale because it's an agricultural product and you don't always know how much you're going to get, regardless of how much you try to plan that out. It has a lot to do with the weather and the bees and if the bears get into it or not. So Charles decided to add tea to the honey as sort of a nice, obvious pairing. And that did really well. And then I just thought, well, I'm not loving the coffee options that I have. There were a few places, but I thought I could offer something different in the mix. And so we started doing that. I started roasting with just a little half pound sample roaster that's more of like a home kind of thing. And if you think about it, I had it because coffee shrinks a bit when you roast it. So I had to roast three batches of that to make 2 12-ounce bags of coffee to put on our table. So it would take me 2 days roasting for 8 or 9 hours to get enough coffee to put on the table for one farmer's market. And it would be gone in an hour. And then restaurants and people started coming saying, hey, can I buy a 5-pound bag? And I thought, oh my gosh, that would take me all day for 1 5-pound bag. So we decided, you know, if we want to make this go, we're going to have to get some real commercial equipment and a space and do it properly. Because we've been working out of the co-working kitchen that was at the Narrowsburg Union at the time. Now it's turned into a lovely little bakery. But we leased our space in Narrowsburg on Kirk's Road and did Kickstarter and got the roaster and just went to work. And we opened the store 6 months before the first pandemic shutdown.
I know, that is so crazy. Your timing is impeccable because you had that happen and you moved to New York and then 9/11.
We moved to New York City 6 months before 9/11 happened, which was a crazy bout of timing also. But yeah, we have a real knack for that, apparently.
We do. But we were talking before about having to be resilient in this crazy world. And you and Charles are certainly resilient. And it's very exciting that you're going to be opening up another part of your shop in Narrowsburg on Main Street.
Yes, so we're expanding and opening a bigger cafe over in 90 Main, which was known by folks as the old Rasmussen building that caught fire several years ago. So now Laura and Nick Santana are redeveloping it. It's going to be really terrific. And so we've secured ourselves a little spot over there with river views, and it's going to give us an opportunity to really do more with our brand than we've been able to in our little tiny 600 square foot shop over in the plaza.
So but that's, you're keeping that shop as well, right?
Yes, we'll be keeping that. We actually have a new roaster that's going to increase our productivity by about 5 times. That's supposed to come this week. So that's very exciting.
Oh, that's fantastic. Well, you know, I also want to acknowledge your contribution to Logging Days, which they just celebrated in Narrowsburg a couple of weeks ago, maybe a month ago at this point.
Yeah, it's a great event.
Yeah, and you really helped kick that into high gear. And you also, as I very well know, were on the board of WJFF at one time. So I just want to thank you for being so active in the community and contributing so much. And thank you so much for joining me today.
Absolutely. Community is what it's all about. I'm 100% here for that.
Yeah. Thank you, Martin.
Very good. Thank you, Donna.
You've been listening to Catskill Character on Radio Catskill. My guest today has been T. Martin Higgins. The website for Two Queens is queenscoffee.com. Catskill Character is on every Saturday at 11:30, except for the last Saturday of the month when Greg Triggs brings us Travels with Triggs. Please join us every Saturday for more conversations with fascinating characters of the Catskills and beyond. I'm Donna Fellenberg. Thanks so much for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Van Gorder's Furniture, featuring Lodge and Adirondack styles as well as rustic collections. With showrooms at Lake Wallenpaupack, downtown Honesdale, and Milford, PA. Van Gorder's Furniture brings the outdoors inside. VanGorders.com. From Dog Mountain Lodge, providing dog boarding and grooming, also boarding cats, birds, and other exotic pets. Located in Keshekta, New York, and on the web at DogMountainLodge.com. And from listeners like you.
On last week's Wait Wait, Amber Ruffin, who plays the new purple M&M in the commercials, realizes she could have gotten a better deal.
Wait, right? Did you get like a lifetime supply of M&Ms?
No, why aren't you my agent?
I'm Peter Sagal. Bring your own snacks as you listen to this week's show featuring actor Craig Robinson. That's Wait Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Sunday morning at 10 on Radio Catskill.
Fentanyl is 50 times stronger than heroin. Even the smallest amount can be lethal. And Sullivan County has the highest opioid overdose rate in New York State. Help save lives. Learn the common signs of opioid use disorder. Spread awareness. And carry a life-saving naloxone kit. Available at Sullivan County's Public Health Office, 50 Community Lane, Liberty, or from your local pharmacy. Learn more at healtogetherny.org/Sullivan. Paid for by Sullivan County Government.
WJFF Jeffersonville, W233AH Monticello.
Radio Catskill.
On air, online, on your smartphone, and on your smart speaker.
public radio for the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania. We are Radio Catskill, keeping you connected.